Welcome to Dermatologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Michael Postal from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And to begin, I asked him about the combination of anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 antibodies for patients with metastatic melanoma.
It's a really important question. It's an important question for patients with melanoma, but also, as we are seeing now, combination immune therapy for kidney cancer, for lung cancer, and likely in other cancers as time goes on. And the real issue is that we need to know who is going to respond to single agent immune therapy so that we could ideally give people the best chance of response with as little toxicity as absolutely possible. I think the challenge always is that we know when you combine more drugs together, you get higher response rates in the short run than if you give one drug by itself. So I think the controversy arises when you combine treatments together, you have a lot more toxicity. Who is it really worth it for to impose that additional toxicity burden on? And what are the long-term benefits of this type of combination strategy?
Before you kind of get into the clinical research data, maybe you could take a step back and just review with us now. I mean, you know, immunotherapy has been out there a while. We're learning a lot more about sort of the pathophysiology mechanisms, kind of how you see how anti-CTLA-4 agents work, how PD-1, PD-L1 agents work, and what the potential synergy is there.
Absolutely. So CTLA-4 was the first immune therapy checkpoint that was developed. And CTLA-4 normally is a molecule on T cells that prevents T cells from becoming too activated. So when T cells get activated to fight off something that shouldn't be in the body, including cancer, CTLA-4 comes up on the cell surface and turns off those T cells or turns them down. And so when you block CTLA-4, it prevents this turn-off signal from being active, and therefore the T cells are more active. And it's a very early signal in the immune response. And so when you block CTLA-4, it causes a lot of toxicities because it really globally disinhibits the immune system in a very generalized way. PD-1, PD-L1 blockade, the other type of immune checkpoint blockade that's very common in cancer patients, acts a little bit more downstream, if you will, than the CTLA-4 molecule. And therefore, one of the theories why PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade is better tolerated than CTLA-4 blockade is because the action of the drugs that block PD-1 and PD-L1 occur more in tumor microenvironments, more at a later step in the immune response. And therefore, the T cell activity is more focused on where you want it to be, which is in the tumor microenvironment, rather than early in an immune response where you get more global disinhibition of the immune response with CTLA-4 blockade. And so that's maybe why toxicities are a little different with PD-1, PD-L1, and CTLA-4 blockade. But that's also the reason why there's been interest in trying to combine these strategies, because they both work at boosting the immune response in very different steps along the immune cascade. And therefore, there's the idea that you could maybe get at least additive benefit with combining blockade of both.
So within that model, you know, one of the concepts we've heard discussed over the years is the so-called hot tumor. Like, what does that mean? And how does that fit into this model you started to describe?
A hot tumor is a tumor that we believe is ripe for an immune response to come and destroy it. So a hot tumor may be one that has a pre-existing immune response already in it. So a lot of T cells that are trying to destroy the cancer, but they just can't quite get over the hump. So an immune response has already been generated against this tumor, maybe because it has a lot of mutations, a lot of neoantigens. It looks really different to the immune system for some way. And the T cells are all in the tumor. They're trying to fight the tumor. That's a hot tumor. There's a lot of immune reaction going on, but for some reason, the immune cells can't completely destroy the tumor, and they just need a little push with immune therapy to get over the hump and cause the tumor to be destroyed. A cold tumor, by contrast, is basically a tumor where there is not much of an immune response at all. So when you try to mount an immune response to a cold tumor, you may need to use combination treatment to get more T cells into the tumor microenvironment or boost it with multiple different strategies. Because if you think about it, it's much more difficult to conquer a cold tumor for the immune system than a hot tumor, because the immune system is already reacting against a hot tumor in many ways, and it just needs a little extra push. But the cold tumors, for whatever reason, you need probably multiple different strategies and combination approaches to help destroy the cold tumors.
The other thing I've heard talked about related to this idea of combination therapies, somehow it's related to the node, that the anti-CTLA-4 works, what, in the node or before it gets, does it have anything to do with anatomy here?
It does a bit. When you block CTLA-4, it boosts T-cell responses early in an immune response in the priming phase. And the priming phase is when these T-cells are first coming in contact with antigen that's getting these T-cells excited. And many times that occurs in lymph nodes. So if you think about CTLA-4 and where the molecule is really acting, it's very early in an immune response at the priming phase. And that's when different cells like dendritic cells are showing off the antigen from tumors to T cells. And many times that's occurring in the lymph nodes. So that's one of the sites in the body where there's T cell priming and CTLA-4 works. So CTLA-4, one could say, has a lot of activity in the lymph nodes, and PD-1, PD-L1 is more in tumor microenvironments. But as we're seeing as well, that's a little bit of an oversimplification, and I don't want to get into all the different minutiae of all the different multiple places that CTLA-4 blockade works, but another theory is that CTLA-4 blockade does not only work in lymph nodes in increasing the T-cell activity there, but also CTLA-4 blockade may have a role in the tumor microenvironment as well. So there's a lot of interest in new ways to get CTLA-4 into tumor microenvironments to help immune responses within that location in addition to the lymph nodes.
So I want to bring in another concept that you hear about, and it kind of seems like we're hearing more about in lung cancer related to combination therapy, which is tumor mutation burden. Do you want to take a crack at explaining what that is? It seems like I don't hear much about that in melanoma. You hear a lot about it, like in other things like lung cancer. Go for it.
Absolutely. So tumor mutation, a lot to talk about for tumor mutation burden. It's a really important concept. And the idea here is that one of the reasons people think that the immune system doesn't normally destroy cancers is that because cancers come from our normal body tissue, and our immune system is programmed to avoid reacting against normal body tissue, otherwise we would have too much autoimmune disease. So because cancer cells arise from our normal body tissue, the immune system normally is restrained against dealing with cancer cells emerging from our own body tissue because our immune system is programmed not to attack normal body tissue. But tumors are different from normal body tissue. There are different mutations that arise within them that make the immune system recognize them as something foreign to normal body tissue. And tumor mutation burden is a term that specifically reflects how many different kinds of mutations are present within a cancer that might be different from a normal healthy tissue in the body. So if you have a lung cancer and a lung tumor that's growing, and there's a lot of mutations within that lung cancer tumor, that looks different to the immune system than a patient's normal lung tissue. And the idea there is hopefully the immune system would recognize that as more different than normal lung tissue. So if you have a lot of mutations in the tumor, the idea is that hopefully the immune system would say, that looks really weird and really, really different, and I'm going to go attack that as something that's different from normal body tissue. And what we've seen from many, many studies of patients getting immune therapies, namely checkpoint inhibitors, is that patients that have either cancers that have lots of mutations, like melanoma, because ultraviolet light causes lots of mutations, or lung cancer, especially people who smoke, that causes lots of mutations in the lung tumors. And there's some theories that patients who smoke have better responses to immune therapy. Not a reason to go out and start smoking, but an interesting scientific principle that if you have a lot of mutations that have been caused by cigarette smoke, maybe those are the lung tumors that respond better to immune checkpoint blockade. And so the idea there is that one of the measures of this hot tumor that we were talking about, one that has this immune response already activated against it, is how different is this tumor from normal healthy body tissue? Specifically, how many different mutations are present that might differ from normal healthy tissue? So tumor mutation burden, one of the factors that's associated with response to checkpoint blockade, not everything. There are patients with low tumor mutation burden that have great responses to treatment, patients with high tumor mutation burden that don't respond at all. So this is all along a spectrum, and we don't really have a cut point quite yet where we can really say you will or you will not respond to checkpoint inhibitors. But it's an interesting scientific principle.
So your colleague in lung cancer, Matt Hellman, presented data in non-small cell, and now we're seeing data in small cell, but in non-small cell, it kind of looked like the patients with low PD-L1 and high tumor mutation burdens did better with the combination. Has that concept been looked at in melanoma, and do you buy into it for lung cancer?
So PD-L1, in addition to tumor mutation burden, is associated with this hot tumor microenvironment. And I think the theory there really is when you have low PD-L1 and you don't have a lot of immune reaction against the tumor, you may need combination treatment. And in melanoma and the CheckMate 067 study, which is the phase 3 study comparing ipilimumab plus nivolumab, nivolumab alone, and ipilimumab alone, the first data reports, at least the 3-year survival data, suggested that there may be a bit of a better benefit for combination over PD-1 alone in patients who are PD-L1 negative, suggested that if you don't have a lot of immune response against your tumor, you may need combination treatment. That's not completely perfectly aligned, but I think the same story is emerging in lung cancer and other tumors, that if you look at the people who are defined as cold tumors, low tumor mutation burden, PD-L1 negative, maybe those are people that really should be treated with combination checkpoint blockade. The lung data are very interesting. Ipilimumab and nivolumab has been explored most extensively in patients with high tumor mutation burden. And that perhaps might be a group that ultimately would get the best benefit from combination immune therapy. We don't really completely quite know that just yet. It's still ongoing research in large lung cancer trials.
When you look, though, at, for example, that data set, the clinical research data set you just talked about, where the PD-L1 levels seem to, you know, maybe predict benefit in melanoma for the combination, were those patients looked at in terms of tumor mutation burden?
In the melanoma data set, not yet. We only have PD-L1.
Is there enough variation that would it be worth looking at? Is it going to be looked at?
I think it would be worthwhile to look at.
It's kind of weird that you have lung cancer doing it.
Lung cancer is ahead of us now. We, in melanoma, were first because we didn't, unfortunately, have treatments that worked all that well for melanoma in the past, namely chemotherapy, interleukin-2, interferon. They worked to a degree in some patients really profoundly, but the vast majority of patients didn't benefit. So melanoma was ripe for trying all kinds of crazy ideas, and that's where all these treatments originated. However, lung has really, I think, in many ways, taken the lead, and I think they're doing so because they have so many more patients. They can answer questions much more quickly because they can run big randomized trials much more quickly just due to the number of people with lung cancer. So they're answering really important questions about, is PD-L1 a predictive biomarker? Is tumor mutation burden a predictive biomarker? And I think we now have a lot to learn from lung in the melanoma experience.
Well, you know, the thing that's been kind of interesting, we've been doing a lot more lung CME than terminologic or melanoma, unfortunately. But so I've been trying to figure out what's been going on. But when those data came out, it looked like it was telling a logical story from a translational point of view, clinical point of view. And then I started to ask investigators and they just kind of weren't doing it. They weren't even doing PD-L1. I don't know. Do you actually even look at assays? I've heard a lot of your colleagues say they don't even get PD-L1 levels.
In melanoma, PD-L1 is really controversial. Melanoma, thankfully, is a tumor type that responds very, very well to checkpoint blockade. And so we have learned that even if someone is PD-L1 negative, they can still have an amazing response to PD-1-based immunotherapy. And therefore, PD-L1 should never exclude a patient from trying one of these immune therapy drugs.
But I mean, why wouldn't you want to look at it, though? Do you look at it?
I don't look at it. And
you don't even order. Incidentally, is there any issue in your mind? Because I have heard people question the quality of the assay data itself. Is that part of your issue here? But you don't really hear that like in lung and other tumors.
Yeah, but we're getting better across the whole immune therapy field at understanding what does PD-L1 positivity mean and what does negativity mean. There's a lot of discussion about, since this is a continuum, you can be strongly positive, you can be weakly positive, there are percent positivities, you can be 95% positive, 2% positive. Essentially, if you call someone positive or negative, you're making a decision that's kind of a black and white decision, but really there are a lot of shades of gray here. So that's one issue with PD-L1. The second issue with PD-L1, what type of antibody are you using to test for this positivity or negativity? And the third issue with PD-L1, which I think is actually the most important, as what we've seen is even within one tumor, there are pockets of the tumor that can be PD-L1 positive and pockets of the tumor that can be PD-L1 negative. And within the same patient, you can have some tumors that are PD-L1 positive and some tumors that are PD-L1 negative. So this just leads to questions of, it probably just matters where you stick the needle in terms of what response you may get. That being said, with all the caveats of PD-L1 and how much we can really truly believe one specific result, there has been still this consistent signal that it is a better outcome from immune checkpoint blockade if you're PD-L1 positive than if you're PD-L1 negative. So there is some inclination that this matters, but it's really hard to make treatment decisions because in the clinic, you have to go one way or you go the other way. And patients want you to come up with, we need to do this and here's why, or we need to do that and here's why. My personal belief around PD-L1, at least in melanoma, where there are so many other factors that you have to consider in the decision. Do you treat a patient with BRAF-MEK targeted therapy? Do you treat them with PD-1 alone, or do you treat them with combinations of CTLA-4 and PD-1 together? The decision is so much more on all these other intangible factors that I can't really find in my practice that PD-L1 makes a major difference in that decision-making.
So some of the factors I've heard about, and I'm curious how you think them through, one is the brain. How much better is the combination than single agent in terms of the brain?
The brain is one of the areas where combination checkpoint blockade, I think, has really definitively proven superiority to single agent PD-1 blockade. We're talking about response rates in the high 40s to mid 50% range for a combination checkpoint blockade in the brain. And we're talking about response rates of around 20-ish percent for single agent PD-1. So this is more than twice as good of a response rate in the brain with combination checkpoint blockade. And the brain is also a place where you don't want to lose a response. It's such an important area that it's really critical if you have a patient with brain metastases that you start to turn that disease in the right direction. So we've now seen from two prospective studies in melanoma of the combination of nivolumab plus ipilimumab, how well it can work in the brain. And the response rates in the brain really look like the same as the response rates in the body. So the brain is an organ just like every other organ in the body. And although it's a separate compartment, we have to think about unique issues related to brain metastases and melanoma. I really think that we should be thinking more strongly about combination checkpoint blockade for patients with brain metastases than single agent because of the more than doubling response rates that we'll see.
Brain's an issue in people who don't have clinical brain mets too, because it's always a potential concern, which leads to what I kind of am hearing as a clinical algorithm that has evolved in melanoma concerning this, which is kind of a preference to use the combination if you think the patient can get through it, i.e. they're younger, they're in good condition, they're motivated, you know, whatever it might be. But to be fine, if not, the patient's older, whatever. But I don't know, is that your philosophy?
If you take toxicity out of the question, and I know that's not fair to do because that's an important consideration, but if you just put that to the side for a moment and you look at pure efficacy, I think the combination is the most effective when you look at all the immune therapy strategies in melanoma. It has the highest response rate. You can argue about the survival results long term. It was not a powered study to look at Nivo plus Ipi versus Nivo alone, and pembrolizumab and nivolumab are equivalent drugs in terms of efficacy as well. So lots of debate in terms of whether any perceived differences, which are not statistically significant in terms of long-term survival, favor combination. But in the end of the day, if you put toxicity to the side, it's really a question about the combination still driving the most pure efficacy in the brain, highest response rate. So the question then becomes a toxicity question. How much are we going to be hurting these patients with the combination? How much experience do we have nursing patients through these toxicities that they experience? Which patients is it worth taking the much bigger risk to give them combination checkpoint blockade? Because that's not an easy question. And there are people that if you select them poorly for combination blockade, you can really, really hurt them with the toxicities. And so it's very, very hard to try to pick the patients who can tolerate the combination and who you may think really need the combination. And you hope that maybe some people could just get away with PD-1 by itself. And I think the bottom line for medicine is, in melanoma at least, is both treatment strategies, single agent PD-1 and combination checkpoint blockade, both are totally reasonable because we don't have a really clear-cut winner in all situations yet.
So in terms of toxicity, when you look at the combination, are you pretty much basically talking about the IPI, the anti-CTLA-4, as adding the toxicity? And how much of that is dose-dependent? How are you approaching dosing?
When I've been speaking about combination checkpoint blockade in melanoma, I'm specifically referring to the ipilimumab plus PD-1 combination strategy. As time goes on, we are clearly going to be talking about many more combinations with PD-1 than the ipilimumab combination. That's what we've started with because we had these drugs and we decided to combine them in melanoma first. So over time, we hope other PD-1 combinations are just as effective with lower toxicities. In terms of the ipilimumab PD-1 combination specifically, there definitely is a question about how much ipilimumab do you need to add to PD-1 to get this enhancement in response rate. And the phase 3 studies, the phase 2 studies in melanoma, they used the high dose of ipilimumab, which is 3 milligrams per kilogram, combined with the lower dose of nivolumab, 1 milligram per kilogram. So that's more ipilimumab relative to nivolumab in the melanoma ipi-nivo combination. In lung cancer, In kidney cancer, it's a lower dose of ipilimumab combined with nivolumab. And in melanoma, there have been studies that have tested lower doses of ipilimumab with PD-1 agents, and specifically low dose of ipilimumab plus pembrolizumab. And we've seen that even when you add a low dose of ipilimumab to PD-1, either pembrolizumab, for example, or nivolumab, you could still see that it looks like there's something additive to PD-1 that you're getting. But ipilimumab has a dose-dependent effect in terms of toxicities. So our hope is that perhaps with more investigation of lower doses of ipilimumab plus PD-1, you'll still get that benefit in terms of efficacy with hopefully better toxicities. We've known in the past that higher doses of ipilimumab monotherapy, much more toxicity than lower doses of ipilimumab monotherapy, and that's proving true in the combination with PD-1 as well. So hopefully we will try to sort this out. Melanoma used a higher dose of ipilimumab historically because that was the dose that was shown to have an overall survival benefit as a single agent, the 3 mg/kg. But over time, it could be quite possible that it changes to 1 mg/kg of ipilimumab with nivolumab.
What do we know and what will we know in the future? I'm not even sure exactly what's being studied in melanoma right now in terms of particularly other anti-CTLA-4 agents. I mean, there are some out there and even anti-PD-1, PD-L1 agents. Are we going to see clinical research being reported over the next few years with other agents?
In melanoma, the other CTLA-4 antibody, tremelimumab, had been tested. And unfortunately, that was a negative phase 3 study. But there is an emerging area of interest with CTLA-4 blockade in general in many, many different kinds of cancers. So tremelimumab is being tested in multiple different types of cancers, namely in combination with PD-1, PD-L1 type drugs. So there's definitely interest in that treatment in those different kinds of cancers. We're also seeing different strategies of CTLA-4 blockade in early phase clinical trials. So ways that different CTLA-4 antibodies can be engineered to help facilitate certain mechanisms of their action and help reduce toxicity. So different strategies, like different antibodies that only get activated in the tumor microenvironments, that's one strategy of CTLA-4 blockade that's emerging. There are strategies that enhance CTLA-4 blockade's depletion of T regulatory immunosuppressive cells. So that's another strategy that's being tested. Those are mostly phase 1 clinical trials, so not a lot to speak of in terms of efficacy at this point, but all kinds of different ways we're testing new CTLA-4 blocking antibodies in many different types of cancers. And PD-1, PD-L1 blockade, similarly, not just giving an antibody that blocks PD-1 or PD-L1, but trying to engineer those antibodies so they can localize some of their effects to tumor microenvironments more specifically. Those are the kinds of ways we're trying to engineer these antibodies to really try to improve upon their efficacy and reduce toxicity.
So I want to ask you in a minute in terms of other checkpoints that are being looked at in terms of blockade, but I kind of want to get a little bit of a feel for you. You were mentioning how immune responsive melanoma is in general. And I'm curious, as you kind of look at it globally, everything that you would consider, the rate of response, the depth of response, cure, the brain, et cetera, how would you sort of globally compare the anti-tumor efficacy of, let's just say, the best immunotherapy, so combination treatment with BRAF-MEK combinations in BRAF-positive disease?
That's one of the most important questions in the melanoma field. If you have a patient with a BRAF mutation, how do you think about BRAF-MEK inhibitors versus PD-1 plus CTLA-4 blockade? And in fact, there are many randomized trials that are going on to test this specifically. It's amazing in the melanoma field, there are trials going on testing targeted therapy versus immune therapy, but we have no prospective randomized data yet to comment on what's more effective between BRAF-MEK targeted therapy versus PD-1 plus CTLA-4 efficacy. So most of what we're left to do is compare across different trials to try to say, how do these combinations of BRAF and MEK inhibitors look in one trial versus how do combinations of PD-1 and CTLA-4 blockade look in other trials? I think people generally feel that there is still no more certainty that you're going to have for a patient's immediate benefit than you get with the BRAF and MEK combinations of treatment. If you have a patient that you really need to make sure you turn their disease in the right direction, the BRAF and MEK inhibitors still offer the highest confidence of having that immediate response, immediate palliation within hours or days of starting the BRAF and MEK inhibitor. So if I have a patient with a BRAF mutation and I need to really get their disease turned around right away, I still reach for BRAF and MEK inhibitors. And those can be really, really powerful treatments. And then there's been this kind of whole discussion, well, everyone responds to BRAF and MEK inhibitors, but then the problem is everyone gets resistant to them. And that's just absolutely not true. We have seen with long-term data from BRAF and MEK inhibitor clinical trials that there are a subgroup of patients, namely those that you would expect would do well, good prognostic patients with few sites of disease, normal LDH, and generally good performance statuses. Those patients can have a really prolonged benefit with BRAF and MEK inhibitors. And I have people that have been on BRAF and MEK inhibitors for years in many contexts. And so we just need to figure out who are the people that are going to benefit long-term with BRAF and MEK inhibitors, who are the people that we need to treat upfront with BRAF and MEK inhibitors, and who are the people that we should think about some kind of sandwich of immune therapy, BRAF MEK inhibitors, or vice versa. And I think we don't really know yet how we're going to best do that.
Do you have patients in your practice who you've treated for metastatic disease with either immunotherapy or targeted therapy that you think are cured?
I really hope so. I think the notion of a cure is a really important one for patients. There have been people that I've treated. Usually they have a very small amount of melanoma, and then it disappears on their scans. And we've stopped treatment for different various reasons, side effects, or maybe they finished a year or two of treatment. We've stopped treatment. There's no evidence of melanoma on their scans. I see them for what I call well baby checks and social visits to catch up on their travel all around the world and what's happening with their family and looking at photos of their kids' weddings or new grandkids and things like this. These people might be cured. I don't know. Now, when patients ask me that all the time, they say, am I cured? Am I in remission? Or what kind of words do I use for those kinds of patients? I don't really know what the right word exactly is for these kinds of situations because we still, unfortunately, don't have really long-term follow-up. So I don't have 5-10-year follow-up on some of these patients and drugs. But what I'll say is that I use the word dormant and I use the word sleeping. And I say, well, your melanoma is dormant, your melanoma is sleeping. We have no evidence of disease on your scans and we're babysitting you. I'm a little bit of a conservative person, so I hesitate to come in and really celebrate and say you're cured because maybe I'm just superstitious and I don't want to invoke any bad karma that could cause a problem with the melanoma moving forward. But there's a quite distinct possibility that some of these patients are going to go for years and years and years, if not decades, without any melanoma problems at all. And eventually, unfortunately, no one lives forever. But if the melanoma kind of goes away, you don't see it anymore, and someone grows to be 100 years old and, you know, passes away in their sleep for some other reason, then I would say their melanoma was cured.
So let's talk a little bit about toxicity. Obviously, it's a huge question that goes way beyond melanoma. I have to tell you that a case you presented at a conference became my all-time toxicity case that I present, and, you know, breast cancer everywhere. That was the patient who had the hypophysitis, and I think the patient had brain mets, and I think it was ipi-nivo. I don't remember, was it?
Ipi-nivo, yeah.
Right, and then the patient comes in with headache. And the family's all panicked that it's the brain mets getting worse. And the brain mets are gone and the patient has hypophysitis. So anyhow, that's my favorite case.
It's a really good case.
How many times have you seen hypophysitis, incidentally?
Oh, it happens all the time.
Really?
It really happens all the time.
Really?
And in many ways, it's a very interesting kind of situation. It happens a lot with CTLA-4 blockade plus PD-1. It doesn't happen that much with PD-1 alone.
Huh.
But I think in many ways, I'm very pleased to explain a headache in a patient with a cancer like melanoma that goes to the brain all the time with inflammation of a pituitary.
I know. I just thinking about that whole thing is incredible. Even you, I'm sure, you know, go through a lot of anxiety.
Oh, because headache and cancer equals brain mets until proven otherwise. And I'm very glad to have another explanation.
But I have heard, and I think maybe, I don't remember with this patient, that there's sort of a characteristic headache. Like if you hear that, you kind of think that's what it is, hypophysitis?
Headache and fatigue and the lack of other neurologic symptoms. I think that's a big issue. If you have a lot of brain metastases that are causing headache, usually someone may have another neurologic symptom. And you kind of just know it when you see it, when it's the brain metastases, but you really have to get an MRI to be certain. Hypophysitis can masquerade as so many different types of things. I've seen people blown off as just being depressed because they have cancer and being tired because you have cancer, and patients that come in and just say, I've just not been myself. I'm exhausted. I can't work. I just feel down. And everyone says, well, of course, you have metastatic cancer now and you're getting treatment and, you know, go see the psychiatrist, or, you know, it's okay to feel this way because this is a tough diagnosis.
Wow.
But in the end of the day, then you find out that this is because of secondary adrenal insufficiency from hypophysitis. You put someone on steroids and they immediately start to feel better. They go back to work. It's an amazing kind of diagnosis to make in many ways. And I think it's good to make sure you're thinking about it. If you don't think about it, you won't diagnose it.
I'm curious that you say you think it is common in your experience. What kind of endocrine abnormalities do you see in these patients? Are they panhypopit or not necessarily?
When hypophysitis presents itself, often it is the adrenal cortical axis that can be affected, so low adrenal function due to poor ACTH secretion by the pituitary. And then the other common hormone that can be affected is secondary hypothyroidism. So if the pituitary is not producing ACTH, you'll have low cortisol, and you need to supplement that with hydrocortisone. If the pituitary is producing low amounts of TSH, you will have low thyroid function, and you need to supplement that with drugs like levothyroxine. Those are the most common two hormones to be affected, but we really haven't studied a lot about gonadotropin deficiency. What does it mean if you have hypophysitis? Is your testosterone low? What are the consequences of that? Is your estradiol low for women? Does it affect the menstrual cycle? What are the consequences of low FSH and LH in patients that have hypophysitis? What does that mean for long-term effects? This is really relevant for adjuvant checkpoint blockade when we're treating a lot of young, healthy men and women, many of whom are planning future fertility issues and other things. What happens when the hormones get messed up in the pituitary gland and they may want to have kids in the future? I've been instructed by a reproductive endocrinologist that as long as it's only isolated to pituitary dysfunction, those hormones can be supplemented in those patients to have future children. So it's invoking a whole new field of research, which is really bringing in this whole other hormones affected, long-term consequences of hormone deficiency. Patients who are otherwise cured from melanoma or perhaps other cancers when you're using these checkpoint inhibitors in the adjuvant setting, and a whole new issue of long-term issues with this, mostly because the endocrinopathies can be permanent.
So I have to confess, I didn't read the article in the JCO on toxicity of checkpoint inhibitors to see what they said about hypophysitis, but I assume the way you'd screen for it would be with blood work rather than imaging.
One can check blood work. It's easier than getting brain MRIs, which is the other way to look for hypophysitis. The blood work that can often be tested would just be a simple TSH or ACTH test and cortisol. So if you see TSH and ACTH low in the blood work, that might get one thinking about hypophysitis. It's much easier to check those labs when you're seeing patients than it is ordering brain MRIs all the time. In melanoma patients, I start with the brain MRI at baseline because it's important to have the brain imaged at baseline in metastatic patients with melanoma to ensure that there's no brain metastases. But when I have a patient who's symptomatic with headache or other symptoms of hypophysitis, you may need to get a brain MRI to look for hypophysitis. And it's really important you communicate with your radiologist, because radiologists will see in the clinical history metastatic melanoma headache and they'll tell you no brain metastases, but they won't necessarily look carefully at the pituitary gland. So you need to say, metastatic melanoma or metastatic lung cancer on immune therapy, evaluate pituitary gland and rule out brain metastases. And that'll prompt these radiologists who are learning about this to look for that.
And when you do see imaging evidence of hypophysitis, does it reverse?
It does. After the event of hypophysitis has occurred, usually the pituitary gland, which often will swell in size, can shrink. And sometimes it'll actually shrink to smaller than it even was in the beginning. So it's kind of like a little shrunken down scar of what it was previously.
Interesting. How long does it take the headache to go away?
Once you start steroids, the headache usually gets better in a day or two.
I was just flashing on the fact that the other day I was interviewing Dave Spiegel from Sarah Cannon, a lung cancer investigator. I think he said that he felt, because we were talking about patients with complications, and he was commenting that he thought that when people get autoimmune complications, they tend to be just one organ. Although I see your patient here had several problems. So first of all, is that your experience with melanoma? I'm not even sure it's true in lung cancer. He had that clinical feeling that you don't see multiple organs attack. You see one that, you know, maybe shows up. And the other thing that he said, very anecdotally, is that he thought maybe there's a correlation between toxicity and benefit. So pure speculation, but, you know, it's always fun. What about these two questions?
The first question about how many numbers of organs are involved with treatment when you're giving checkpoint inhibitors. We know when you combine two checkpoint inhibitors together, like CTLA-4 blockade and PD-1 blockade, you have an increase in the number of organs involved. So in melanoma, we're giving more CTLA-4 blockade and PD-1 blockade, perhaps, than they are in lung, because it's not yet standard clinical practice in lung. So
yeah, absolutely.
I think in melanoma, we're seeing many more patients with multiple organs involved, probably because we're giving more combination checkpoint blockade. Single agent PD-1 blockade, of course, it's much, much better tolerated than the combinations of CTLA-4 and PD-1 blockade. So with single agent PD-1 blockade, you may only really have one organ involved, liver, skin, something like this. But with the combinations in melanoma, it is quite common to have multiple organs involved. And I think that's also compounded by the fact that in melanoma, we're using a dose of ipilimumab that's 3 times higher than the dose that they're using in lung and renal cell carcinoma. So we're giving more combination ipi and nivo in melanoma. melanoma than other diseases, and we're also using a dose that's 3 times higher. Again, that may change over time as we get more data about lower doses of ipilimumab, but I think the issue is that the clinical feeling of how many organs will be involved is somewhat dependent on where investigators may be coming from with their own clinical experiences. Taking care of melanoma patients, I see multiple organs involved, unfortunately, all the time. And sometimes all different organs get involved at the same time. Sometimes you get one organ involved, you get through it, everyone's happy, and then there's something else that happens in a different organ. So it's really interesting how the timing of all these types of things takes effect and why certain organs characteristically are involved early, middle, and late along the course.
Would you like to kind of state in your own mind what you tell your fellows about those 3 time periods, what you see?
I talk to fellows, I talk to patients. The first toxicity that characteristically occurs is skin toxicity and rash. And so many people will have that present first. It might just be because we know that patients can examine their own skin, so they'll see their rash very quickly, and that just might be the first toxicity that people report. That happens earliest. Side effects like diarrhea usually happen after a few weeks of getting into treatment, and then the liver inflammation can also happen after a few weeks into treatment, and characteristically, endocrinopathies like hypothyroidism or this hypophysitis that we've been speaking about usually happens a little bit later. So that's kind of the pattern that we've seen emerge: skin, GI toxicities, and then the endocrinopathy subsequently. But the range of when these things can happen is really, really wide. So clinicians need to be alert to anything at any time. And I think that's important when you're talking to patients too, because you need to tell them to call you the day of the treatment, the day after the treatment. Anything can really happen all the time, and everyone needs to be alert.
I'm curious, when you see a patient who has a lot of toxicity, in your mind, do you think it's going to be more likely that they're going to have some benefit?
The data from all the retrospective studies that have addressed this are a little bit all over the place in terms of some studies have shown clear correlations with toxicity and benefit. Others have been a little bit less certain. It's not so clear in all different treatment modalities. I think we think with PD-1 monotherapy, any toxicity that the patient has is kind of a good thing. But I guess I kind of use it in that I try to reassure the patients either way. If a patient's suffering from lots of toxicity, I encourage them, your immune system is raging. You know, I think this is a good thing that you're going to have a good tumor response. But I think the key is that you don't have to have terrible toxicity to have a benefit from these treatments. And so if I have a patient without any toxicity, I'll reassure them that you don't have to have toxicity to have a benefit. There is this notion that toxicity may be a good thing with immune therapy responses, but it's not so clear cut in my mind across all the different studies that have been done. But it is a good way to reassure people if they're having bad toxicity. That does mean their immune system is turned on.
So, yeah, I guess you could say on the right target, we think.
Mm-hmm.
So let's finish out this part of our discussion by hearing about your 53-year-old man. If you can briefly tell me what happened there.
Sure. So this was a 53-year-old patient that I had. He had a mucosal melanoma in the mouth area, so head and neck mucosal primary, and had a lymph node involved in his left neck that was biopsy-proven melanoma. We obtained an MRI of the brain at the beginning as a routine standard staging tool, and he had 2 brain metastases that were present. One was in the thalamus, and the other was in the frontal lobe. And so with this patient, he had a very low volume of extracranial disease, just this mucosal melanoma in the mouth and also this lymph node in the neck. But then he had 2 brain metastases. And my decision really was a couple of things. He did not have a BRAF mutation. So if we put the BRAF and MEK decision to the side, we have a patient with mucosal melanoma that's metastatic to lymph node and brain. What's the best initial systemic treatment option for that patient? And the decision really is between single agent PD-1 and combination checkpoint blockade. There were 2 reasons I chose combination checkpoint blockade for this particular patient. Number 1, the brain metastases. Number 2, mucosal melanoma is one of those subtypes of melanoma where the response rates to combination checkpoint blockade are also higher than single agent PD-1 checkpoint blockade. So metastatic mucosal melanoma, single agent PD-1 responses are a little lower than they are with cutaneous melanoma in general.
Any translational correlations or why that's the case? Is their profile different or immune system?
Mucosal melanoma has less mutations than cutaneous melanoma. So one theory is that because we know the story that mucosal sites of disease don't get that UV bombardment that the skin gets all the time.
Interesting.
Maybe that's why a little less responsiveness to PD-1, but still very responsive to PD-1 compared to other cancers. So I think if you have a patient with mucosal melanoma and you don't think they're right for the combination, you should feel very comfortable to be able to give them PD-1 alone. But in this patient with the brain metastases and given my comfort with the combination, I felt like I would give them the combination of 2 checkpoint inhibitor drugs. But it's very reasonable to go either way. But both the mucosal reason in this patient and with the brain metastasis, that's why I went with combination checkpoint blockade.
So what happened?
So this patient got the combination of two checkpoint inhibitors and unfortunately had a lot of different toxicities, three toxicities. The first one was thyroiditis, which is something that's very, very common. We always talk about hypothyroidism happening. Low thyroid people are tired and they need levothyroxine. But many times when patients have hypothyroidism, that hypothyroidism is preceded by a period of hyperthyroidism due to thyroiditis. So you get started with the checkpoint blockade, the thyroid gland gets really, really inflamed, spewing out free T4 all through the body, and people can get really sick with that. They lose tons of weight. They can develop tachyarrhythmias, like this patient had atrial fibrillation that had been happening.
So the patient was clinically hyperthyroid.
Clinically hyperthyroid.
I thought that usually that's thought to be like silent.
Sometimes it can be silent and you just see the TSH go down and the free T4 go up. But sometimes people can be really symptomatic with hyperthyroidism from thyroiditis. And then the inclination is always, I'm going to give an anti-thyroid drug like methimazole, for example, or propylthiouracil to try to block the thyroid hormone secretion. But the reality is that this is not necessarily always like a Graves' disease hyperthyroidism. This is because the thyroid gland is like a factory on fire that's just spewing out thyroid hormone everywhere.
Right. I mean, they don't have exophthalmus. Obviously.
Correct. They don't have exophthalmus. Exactly. So
it's really chemical hyperthyroidism as opposed to, you know, the autoimmune hyperthyroidism.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. The thyroid gland is not necessarily...
It's immune hyperthyroidism. I don't know.
It's all immune related, but it's like if you think about the thyroid gland as a factory, it's not necessarily that the factory production of the thyroid hormone is enhanced, which would be the case in Graves' disease. I like to think of it, the factory is just on fire and everything is just kind of spewing out of this factory that's on fire with the thyroid hormone.
So interesting.
The point, I think, for the education about what to do in this situation is really to tell patients this will burn out over time because you'll eventually become hypothyroidism when this inflamed thyroid gland dies down a little bit. To treat that hyperthyroid phase with symptomatic treatment as needed, like beta blockers or even sometimes low doses of steroids to tampen down the inflammation that's going on, that can help. And then be ready to start levothyroxine because what will happen is that the thyroid hormone will eventually start to go down, the TSH will start to rise. And then, you know, you're hypothyroid. So be ready to start levothyroxine, even in someone who's hyperthyroid. Don't start it at the time that they're hyperthyroid, but just wait and be mindful that you're going to need to start it soon. So I've had people lose tons of weight and then gain tons of weight once they get to that hypothyroid phase.
So how long was it after the first dose of Ipi/Nivo that this started to appear clinically?
Only a few weeks later.
Wow.
Pretty soon afterwards. And that was the first toxicity that this person experienced. And usually the thyroid problems can happen later with PD-1 single agent, but this was a situation where the hyperthyroidism happened pretty early and the thyroiditis.
So then what?
Once that got under control, then unfortunately we had other toxicities that kind of manifest themselves. So namely, this patient developed two other toxicities, hepatitis and pancreatitis. And one of the reasons that I suspected thyroiditis was initially the cause is because his liver was inflamed right around the time that the thyroid gland was overly active. So usually these kinds of things happen as a constellation of different symptoms altogether, especially with the combination of 3 mg/kg of ipilimumab and the lower dose of Nivo that this patient received. So the hepatitis was treated with steroids, and I was using the steroids to also dampen the thyroid inflammation. But once that situation got better, then the pancreas got inflamed. And pancreatitis is a very interesting side effect that we're still really just trying to learn, how do you manage immune-related pancreatitis? Do you need to put people in the hospital and give them fluids and hydration and bowel rest like you may manage normally?
They have pain and the whole scenario? Is that what this man had? Pain? He was sick?
Exactly. Epigastric pain.
Wow.
Some kind of low-level nausea, poor appetite. And it's really, those are non-specific symptoms. So you have to think.
How high were his enzymes?
Amylase and lipase were in the several hundreds, but sometimes in some patients it can go in the thousands. So I don't really believe in checking amylase and lipase in people who are asymptomatic because many times it'll go up and down, and people with abdominal disease like cancer in their abdomen will have high amylase and lipase values. And I don't think that that's reflective of pancreatitis. But when you have someone who's symptomatic, I do suggest checking amylase and lipase, especially with that characteristic epigastric pain and poor appetite. And many times when you get a CAT scan or if you get a PET scan in these situations, the pancreas will be enlarged, it will be inflamed, and this is something you also have to talk to your radiologist about because they won't necessarily look for it. We're all good at looking for colitis. I think there's a lot of familiarity with colitis or enteritis, small bowel inflammation that can happen with these immune checkpoint inhibiting drugs. But it's important to pay attention to the pancreas as well, because with more attention on this, we're seeing pancreatic inflammation. I haven't seen anyone with terrible pancreatitis, like pseudocysts, needing to be in the hospital for weeks on TPN, that kind of really severe case, fortunately. Most cases of immune-related pancreatitis have been successfully treated with prednisone. I've used infliximab in some cases as well, and people do get better from this.
So all this is going on in the first two cycles of treatment, right?
Yeah, very early on, within the first month or two of treatment.
I'm kind of curious. I don't know if you could feel the node or, you know, I guess you could see the primary. What was going on with the disease that you could see and feel?
So we had a hard time really seeing the disease in the back of the mouth. It was something that showed up on an MRI. But one of the issues that I usually like to do is when after someone's been dealing with such toxicity, you can't treat them with more immune therapy drugs. So I like to image to see where are we with the melanoma, or where are we with the cancer right now? Is this continuing to progress, and am I going to really need to be worried about this, or is this patient already having a response? And I think in many cases, when someone's going through terrible toxicity like this, you will see a disease response. And there's nothing that'll make someone feel better psychologically than reassuring them that their cancer is behaving in the way that we want to do. So yes, you feel sick because you're having pancreatitis and thyroiditis and hepatitis or colitis or hypophysitis or whatever it is, but your cancer is really going in the right direction. And then the good news is most of these side effects will resolve with time with treatment with immunosuppressants. As long as the cancer is heading in the right direction, then we should do well. This patient's cancer was going in the right direction. So the thing in the mouth was shrinking, the lymph node was fine, the brain metastases were also responding gently. So that was very, very reassuring. And the message at that point was, we need to hold immune therapy, nurse through these side effects, and hope that we continue that response even if we discontinue immune therapy permanently.
So, and I've heard stories like this, you know, with bad toxicity, had to discontinue treatment. And then the end of the story is, so we decided to just watch the patient, the tumor went away, and now it's 4 years later. But I see here that you gave radiation therapy.
Yeah, this patient's brain metastases were large and they were in bad spots. At least the one in the thalamus was in a bad spot. So I decided to double down on the brain in this particular patient and offer focal radiation to the brain metastases. It's a big question in our field now. Now that we have proof of benefit of ipi/nivo in the brain, who do we also give focal radiation to in the beginning, and who do we see if ipi/nivo will work in the brain and follow it carefully? That's a really important, difficult question. So how do I make that decision in the clinic? When I see a patient with brain metastases, who do I say, let's get you set up with the radiation oncologist to give you radiation and start systemic treatment? Or who do I just say, let's just start systemic treatment and see how things go in the brain? That's a very difficult question. The way I make the decision is if patients have large brain metastases in bad places, if they're symptomatic, or if they're on steroids, those are patients I use radiation upfront in addition to systemic treatment. And that's because we don't really know how well ipi/nivo works in the brain when people are symptomatic or on steroids. And although there is a very promising response rate for ipi/nivo alone in the brain, it's not 100%. And if I have a patient with a metastasis in a bad spot that I don't want to take a basically 50-50 chance on progressing, that's a patient I really want to make sure sees the radiation oncologist and goes for radiation treatment. If I have a patient who's really, really sick with extracranial metastases, so big liver metastases, ascites, shortness of breath for lung disease, and they may have one or two 1-centimeter brain metastases that we pick up as just an incidental finding on a brain MRI, those are the patients I think could start with combination immune therapy alone and follow the brain really carefully, because I think their prognosis is going to be driven by the extracranial metastases, and I'm not sure that they need to go through this really aggressive upfront radiation for very small brain metastases at the same time they're dealing with so much extracranial disease.
How would you sort of globally compare the impact, the benefit that you see with radiation therapy for brain mets and melanoma to, for example, some of the common solid tumors, lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer?
I think the one takeaway is that radiation can be very effective for patients with melanoma, including in the brain. There's this old wives' tale, I guess I would say, that melanoma is radio-resistant and radiation doesn't work for melanoma. And the reality is that's just not true. It absolutely can work very well for patients. And there's an emerging literature. It's not the highest level of data. It's retrospective data. But that suggests perhaps when patients are receiving immune checkpoint blockade, radiation in the brain would even be maybe more effective at the spots that get radiation than even historically radiation alone was for melanoma brain metastases. So I think in the setting of small brain metastases that are approached with focal radiation, melanoma, lung cancer, breast cancer, kidney cancer, whatever type of disease there is in the brain, I support treating these patients aggressively with radiation and or checkpoint blockade if you can, because it can be very, very effective and you don't want to lose control of that area.
Let's talk about targeted therapy, a good segue into that. And we'll start with a metastatic setting. How about this 31-year-old lady? What happened there?
Yeah, so I had a young patient who was very symptomatic with metastatic BRAF mutant melanoma. She had back pain from bony metastases. She had a lung mass.
Where was her primary?
This was unknown primary melanoma, actually. So she presented with back pain.
Wow.
And it's a really tough story. You come in with back pain, you're otherwise young and healthy. Had some imaging of the spine and found bony metastases there. And then that led to a whole bunch of other imaging. Fortunately, there were no brain metastases, but it led to a whole kind of workup and found metastatic melanoma of unknown primary, which can happen in many patients. The primary melanoma is just never detected. Either it was in an area that was not able to be obviously seen, or maybe the body's immune system fought the primary melanoma off and it disappeared, but that it still had metastasite inside the body. So this is metastatic melanoma, unknown primary, BRAF mutant, and very symptomatic disease with back pain as the initial presentation.
Just out of curiosity, when you see very young patients like this, is there a correlation? I'm curious what her sun exposure history was, and is that even relevant?
I do think it is relevant in many patients. There are a lot of young people, unfortunately, with melanoma, and there are some suggestions that intermittent sun exposure, so not necessarily people that have been out working in the fields for their whole life, like older people that have squamous cell, basal cell carcinomas, and then get a melanoma on their scalp or forehead. But younger people that have had a lot of tanning bed exposure, or weekend warriors that go out and fry on the weekends and then work in an office all week, or go on vacation every now and then and sit out for a week and get totally burned. There is some discussion that these BRAF mutant cases are associated with this younger group of demographic patients that have this intermittent sun exposure. And so it's definitely an issue that sun exposure can be a problem, especially given the fact that young people will have melanoma. Unfortunately, melanoma can still happen in places where the sun doesn't shine, for lack of a better expression, and it's clearly not only driven by the sun, but it's really important from a population health perspective to tell patients to be careful in the sun, use sunscreen, limit exposure to sun at the bright times of the day from 10 a.m. to 2 in the afternoon, and even longer than that. But I think it's hard to really know in any one individual case how much the sun contributed to things. But many times when we do mutation analyses of these patients' tumors, you'll see a lot of what are called C to T genetic changes. And that can reflect UV-induced damage that likely resulted in the melanoma in many of these cases.
So, you know, I've asked a lot of lung cancer investigators and oncologists about the issue of regret and lung cancer, for example, with smokers, but I never thought about it in melanoma. Do you find patients, particularly younger ones, who bring this up to you or that you become aware of, who have regrets, who feel, you know, self-blame?
That does happen sometimes, and I think it's unfortunate that people feel this way. And I try to get people to, everyone's obviously very anxious, very depressed, even to have this diagnosis in the first place. So I try to really gear my conversations to focus on how we're going to move forward with the diagnosis, and that it's not so much helpful to go back and say you can't beat yourself up for the whole lifetime that you've lived enjoying yourself, whether you live in a sunny climate or you've been an outdoor kind of person. That's been part of people's lives. It's just who they are, and that's something that you can never take away from somebody. So at this point, I focus on moving forward. One of the questions I get all the time with people with metastatic melanoma is, should I stay inside now, or how much care do I need to take in the sun? And for people with metastatic melanoma, I really tell them the disease that you have at the moment is not going to be further exacerbated by additional sun exposure. So people are worried that being out in the sun, does that make the metastatic melanoma grow faster? And to the best of our knowledge from the research that's available, at least that I'm aware of, it doesn't accelerate the growth of the metastatic melanoma. So I tell people, just be careful, do what you were doing before, but just be cautious. Of course, sun exposure does put people at risk of an additional primary melanoma in the skin, but that's not usually the problem when someone's already facing metastatic melanoma. So I tell people they can't live in a cave. You have stage 3 or stage 4 melanoma. Just be smart. Follow with the dermatologist, and let's just focus on how we can try to make you better.
Interesting. So this patient sounds like a classic, and you were talking before about the decision for metastatic BRAF positive disease and people who need responses. She's got epidural disease. I see also you gave her radiation therapy, getting back to your point about radiation therapy, but then the issue of systemic treatment. And can you talk a little bit, A, about the issue of immunotherapy versus targeted therapy? I think you kind of alluded to how you think it through before, but particularly the issue of choice of targeted therapy in this kind of situation. It seems like we've completely evolved towards the doublet of BRAF-MEK, but we now have three different combinations. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you think through those three options and how you choose one versus the other?
Absolutely. So first, the reason I chose BRAF and MEK in this patient was because of the symptomatic disease and also of the highest degree of confidence with an immediate response with the BRAF-MEK inhibitors, especially someone with epidural disease in the spine. If you don't get that immediate response, you worry about spinal cord issues or other nerve problems. And even though the response rates to combination immune therapy are high, still this BRAF and MEK response confidence is still higher. That almost everyone shrinks initially with the BRAF-MEK inhibitors. Now, how to choose? We have three different BRAF-MEK inhibitor combinations that are out on the market now. Encorafenib, binimetinib is the latest one to come out. We have vemurafenib and cobimetinib, and we have dabrafenib and trametinib. So all three of these are really, really effective combinations. And how do we decide among these three different options, which one is the best? Because really all of them have really promising efficacy. And I think a lot of the decisions for this go on side effects and perceived anticipation of tolerance for side effects.
Just to clarify though, in your mind, and as you mentioned, it's the encorafenib binimetinib is the most recent data. So I'm guessing the follow-up is not as long, but is there any way, and it reminds me when people talk about CDK inhibitors and breast cancer and PARP inhibitors and ovarian cancer, you know, is there any way to differentiate benefit from these combinations?
The only way that you could really distinguish which one might be better than the other is with the encorafenib and binimetinib combination, because in that randomized clinical trial, which was the Columbus trial, vemurafenib monotherapy was one of the comparator arms. And so in that study, it did look like encorafenib was a little bit better of a BRAF inhibitor than vemurafenib. So although none of the other BRAF-MEK combinations were tested against each other, in that one study, encorafenib was kind of tested against vemurafenib, or at least encorafenib and binimetinib were tested against vemurafenib alone. And it looked like encorafenib is a little bit better of a BRAF inhibitor, actually. And so I think that it may be that the encorafenib and binimetinib combination has the best efficacy. And when you look at it, kind of cross-trial comparisons with all those caveats and all the kind of hesitation with, you know, how do you really decide on what to do, I look very favorably on the encorafenib and binimetinib combination. And I think that as we get more experience with it, because it is the newest, we'll really try to understand, is that the go-to first BRAF-MEK combination? Or do we try one of the ones that we have a little more familiarity with, like dabrafenib and trametinib or vemcobi first, and then switch to encorafenib and binimetinib subsequently? And I think we're still trying to figure this out. But I would say that because there's that randomized data with encorafenib against vemurafenib, and it looks like the encorafenib might be a little bit better, at least in the context of one study, I would kind of favor encorafenib and binimetinib or perhaps dabrafenib and trametinib.
I want to ask you in terms of toxicity profiles, but that's interesting that you brought that up. I'm curious, you know, we have this thing, we'll go out and ask 25 investigators stuff, you know, breast cancer, do you use pertuzumab, whatever it might be, just like, what do you think would happen if we asked 25 melanoma investigators? Do you think most would agree with you that they kind of have this feeling maybe there's greater efficacy with the encorafenib binimetinib?
I think so. Yeah, at least over vemurafenib and cobimetinib, or at least the vemurafenib kind of story with the BRAF inhibition specifically. Dabrafenib and trametinib has never at all been compared to the encorafenib and binimetinib. And some could say, well, I go with dabrafenib and trametinib because it's had the most extensive follow-up, the longest term data, the most number of randomized studies with survival benefits. So dabrafenib and trametinib, incredibly established in this area, proven benefit in the CNS with dabrafenib and trametinib, where we don't formally know that for encorafenib and binimetinib. But I think a lot of investigators in the melanoma field are very excited about encorafenib and binimetinib and do generally feel that it's perhaps the most effective BRAF-MEK inhibitor combination. And whether that means it will take over for dabrafenib and trametinib or take over for vemurafenib and cobimetinib still remains a little bit of a question. One of the issues is it is a lot of pills to take with encorafenib and binimetinib. It's 6 pills of the encorafenib every morning and 3 pills of the binimetinib in the morning and 3 pills in the afternoon. So it's a lot of pill taking, and dabrafenib and trametinib has the advantage of fewer pills. So it's 1 trametinib pill in the morning every day and 2 dabrafenib in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. So there's a lot of these kind of nuances. There's issues about whether some of the pills need to be refrigerated, like trametinib needs to be in the refrigerator. So there's some kind of different feelings about kind of which patient might be compliant with what kind of treatment. Cobimetinib with the VEM-COBI experience, cobimetinib is taken 3 weeks on and then 1 week off. So if you're worried about patients that might be confused taking a pill for 3 weeks and then taking a week off and then going back on it, there's all these kinds of decisions. And I think it's great that we actually have 3 different BRAF-MEK inhibitor combinations so that we can try one out for a patient. If it doesn't work from a side effect perspective, we just switch to another one. And I hope that over time, insurance companies will understand that we might need to change from one to another due to tolerability.
It's interesting, as I said, that you brought up this issue of benefit, because I think what I've been hearing about encorafenib and binimetinib is the question of whether it's better tolerated. How do you compare the toxicity profiles and sort of quality life with these 3 regimens?
I think that if you look at the data, encorafenib and binimetinib does have a lower risk of fever and chills than dabrafenib and trametinib. And I think that's one of the major problems with dabrafenib and trametinib. You have patients with rigors and chills and high fevers, and sometimes they have to go to an emergency room because of that. Vemurafenib and cobimetinib has a lot of skin toxicity. I think that's kind of the main thing, sun sensitivity and rashes and some GI issues. Encorafenib and binimetinib, if you look at the clinical trial data, I think it does seem to be the best tolerated BRAF and MEK combination. That might be the case because it's just newer, and maybe it's our feeling that we have a lot of experience with toxicities of the other BRAF and MEK inhibitor combinations, and therefore it's kind of our old friend. We know them good and bad and otherwise with dab, tram, and vem-cobi, and we've seen all the toxicities with those. And so we're attracted to the new kid on the block, the encorafenib and binimetinib, just because we haven't had as much experience with it yet. And we look at the clinical trial data, but we haven't really treated patients to a great extent with it. So we don't really know a lot about the toxicities as much other than looking at the clinical trial data. But I do think there is this notion that's out there that perhaps it has a better tolerability profile than either dab-tram and vem-cobi. And so I would say I think that it remains a very attractive first-line option for patients with BRAF mutant melanoma when they're considering either initial treatment or treatment after immune therapy to go with encorafenib and binimetinib. I'm personally excited about it, and I think we have to try to see which are the patients for which BRAF inhibitor combination. I've come up with little algorithms in my mind about who might be best for one versus the other. I don't know if this is correct, but in the end of the day, we have to choose. And so I've kind of tried to think about this. And historically, older patients I've found don't tolerate the dabrafenib and trametinib fevers very well. So that's a patient I might think for vem-cobi or for encorafenib and binimetinib. Younger patients could tolerate the fevers with dab-tram better, and so I think, you know, that's obviously a good choice for many of them. And then patients who are out in the sun a lot or being very active, the vem-cobi rashes might be more problematic. So these kinds of things, I'm still trying to figure out, even in my own practice, who should get what. And a lot of times, honestly, it's dependent on insurance approvals. What drug can you get in a patient's mouth the fastest? So we try one. If it doesn't work with the insurance companies, we just go for another one very quickly. So
what happened with this lady? First of all, what did she get started on first? I see she got dabrafenib, trametinib. Did she get that or the radiation? What was the timing?
So started with dabrafenib and trametinib, and then radiation was incorporated as we went along. The dabrafenib and trametinib was effective. It shrunk the tumors right away, and it was kind of a question of, should we just rely on the dabrafenib and trametinib alone or consolidate that response with additional radiotherapy? And
wow, interesting. Consolidation.
Yeah, consolidation with some radiation to try to just further optimize on the dabrafenib and trametinib initial response. And that's kind of a questionable clinical decision. I was just very attentive to some of this epidural disease and how much the back pain was causing a problem. And I had confidence that dabrafenib and trametinib obviously was going to work. But
sure. In
these younger patients, I really think we have to offer everything that might help. And knowing that radiation can be effective in melanoma, I wanted to just offer everything that could be helpful. And so we did ultimately give radiation for this patient. But she's still continuing to do very well. It's early along in the course. I think all the treatment started about 4 or 5 months ago, but doing really well in general. So I'm very pleased.
Again, how long was it from the time you started the dabrafenib trametinib to the time she got the radiation?
So some radiation to some other bony areas that were problematic happened right away, and some of the spinal radiation happened after a couple months of dabrafenib and trametinib.
Interesting. And has she had any toxicity issues, any fevers, anything?
I've been lucky with her. No fevers and chills so far, and no other toxicities with the dabrafenib and trametinib. So that's a really remarkable. And
nothing, huh?
Many people just won't have anything at all. And I think we need to try to understand, who are these patients that can tolerate this without any problem? And then who are the people? I've had other patients, they take one dabrafenib pill, and then they'll start getting a low-grade fever. So people are just intrinsically sensitive to these treatments, and this fever and chills problem is a real issue for some people, but other people don't have any problems at all. So I've been very, very lucky with her. And the question really is how long do you stay on BRAF and MEK when it's working so well? Or do you stop this after a certain period of time and switch to immune therapy because you worry about resistance? Those are open questions in the medical literature thus far. We don't really know. You should treat people for 4 months and switch, or you should treat people for 6 months and switch. So I'm going to try to milk this out as long as I can, given how well she's tolerating the treatment and how well it's working for her, following carefully, of course, every couple months with scans. And at the first sign, if there's any resistance, then make the switch to immune therapy.
So just out of curiosity, roughly what fraction of your patients who get combination targeted therapy, like Cruz, no problem, let's say dabrafenib, trametinib, how often do you see that like this?
Most people will respond very well for the first 6 months to a year. So that's, I would say, the vast majority of patients will have a good 6 months to year run of dabrafenib and trametinib.
I'm talking about tolerance, side effects.
Oh, from a tolerance perspective, yeah. So I would say very few people have absolutely nothing.
But she's unusual.
She's unusual, yeah. Most people have something. Not necessarily side effects that are so bad that it limits ongoing dosing. So you could play with different dosing schedules, give it intermittently, 4 days on, 3 days off, or 1 week on, 1 week off. Sometimes if people have had bad fevers and chills, you can give them low doses of prednisone, 5 or 10 milligrams of prednisone a day to see if that can reduce the fever risk, or NSAIDs like Motrin. Sometimes that'll help with fevers. But this is a little bit unusual. It's really like zero toxicities with the dab-tram, and it's amazing. And just to speak to the fact that you never really know who's going to cruise through this without a problem at all.
So that kind of leads into the issue of treatment in the adjuvant setting, where it's kind of a different mindset, and also in terms of how tolerability, toxicity play out. I guess it's been about a year since the world changed, ESMO 2017, in the fall of 2017, all of a sudden PD-1 is out there and targeted therapy as adjuvant therapy. So to kind of get into that, I'd like to hear about your 72-year-old lady. But before you present her, can you just kind of summarize where we are 1 year later in terms of data? I don't know if there have been updates to those original trials that were presented. But globally, when you look at this adjuvant question today, what are some of the key data points that you think about?
The main updates in adjuvant treatment for melanoma are for stage 3 patients that have resected lymph nodes. And what we have are recurrence-free survival data for both dabrafenib, trametinib, and PD-1 drugs. So for dabrafenib and trametinib, we know that it improves recurrence-free survival compared to placebo. And for the PD-1 drugs, we know that pembrolizumab improves recurrence-free survival over placebo, and nivolumab improves recurrence-free survival over ipilimumab adjuvant. So this is a win for both PD-1 drugs, nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and a win for dabrafenib and trametinib. The difference among some of these adjuvant studies is that the control treatment varied in some of these studies. So pembrolizumab beat observation, and dabrafenib and trametinib also beat observation in terms of recurrence-free survival. And then nivolumab beat an active control, ipilimumab. Now, that doesn't mean nivolumab is better than pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting. We have really no idea if that's the case, because some of these trial populations differed a little bit in terms of what risk profile some of these patients were in when they started these adjuvant trials. And we really have no idea what's better between targeted therapy in the adjuvant setting or PD-1-based immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting. And frankly, we don't really know how much better are any of these drugs compared to standard adjuvant old treatments like interferon. So randomized data with interferon are still coming, and we really still have very little information about some of these drugs in terms of overall survival.
So what about relative risk reduction in recurrence with these three types? Understanding it's indirect, one of them compares to active treatment, but even bringing in interferon, you know, if you think about the old data, because I kind of always felt like it was really borderline. It was hard to see the benefit. But in any event, what are the hazard rates that you see in these settings?
So the hazard ratios in some of these trials are reflective of approximately 30 to 40-ish% reductions in risk of recurrence with PD-1 and or BRAF-MEK inhibitor. So hazard ratios 0.57, 0.6-ish, those kinds of hazard ratios. So I think these are very, very strong hazard ratios. And in some contexts, you know, it's like 50-50 in terms of risk reduction with that some of these hazard ratios. So these are really powerful recurrence-free survival improving drugs.
What about with the Nivo-Ipi comparison hazard rate there?
The hazard ratio there, I think, is 0.67. So it's pretty favorable for Nivo over ipilimumab. So I'm very convinced that adjuvant ipilimumab is done, frankly. I think when you have a better tolerated drug with a much more favorable hazard ratio in terms of reducing recurrences.
Just out of curiosity, though, in the old interferon, maybe not that old, but, you know, what kind of risk reduction was seen? Did they do randomized trials?
They did. Interferon was compared to observation mostly in some of these trials. And
right.
Almost always high-dose interferon and pegylated interferon, they had improvements in recurrence-free survival nearly kind of across many, many different trials. So really clear recurrence-free survival benefits. I think the controversy with interferon is all the toxicities that it caused.
But again, you know, in that kind of range of, you know, 30-40% relative reduction?
It was less effective.
That's what I thought, right? Yeah, of course, the toxicity was a gigantic issue.
I think one of the challenges in melanoma is really trying to understand how much benefit are we offering to patients and what is their baseline risk. And we have a new AJCC staging system that has just come out. So I think we're trying to wrestle with all of this. And one of the big challenges in adjuvant for melanoma is the new AJCC system came out after or kind of in parallel to when these adjuvant trials were reported. So the adjuvant trials were formally reported with the AJCC 7th edition staging. So we know kind of relative risk improvements for people with AJCC 7. However, for AJCC 8, we're now retrospectively going back and trying to relook at these adjuvant trials, but with the AJCC 8. There are some abstracts that have been published on that topic, but I think we're wrestling with new adjuvant data with an old staging system, and now we have a new staging system. So if there's a way to kind of synthesize this so we can sit down with the patient, use the most refined staging system that we have that's up to date, and then know how that might apply to the trial data, I think that would really help inform our conversations with patients. One of the also challenges from what we had from the AJCC staging system in general is it still only reflects overall survival and it doesn't reflect recurrence risk. So in an era now where thankfully we've come up with better new treatments and a recurrence event in and of itself does not necessarily mean a patient's going to die from their disease anytime soon, I think we have to recognize that recurrence in and of itself may be divorced from overall survival. So as much as we can try to get data sets where we have recurrence-free survival broken down by risk profile, I think would be helpful. And at least in melanoma, where this field is so rapidly changing, I think that would be a welcome feature if we could have that.
So, of course, the big question is, what do you do with the BRAF-positive patient? And I remember hearing about that. I think it was actually even before ESMO, because the data were out there hearing people talking about this. I'm curious how it played out in the 72-year-old lady. What was her situation?
Yeah, so this woman that I saw, she was 72. She was a little bit different because she had this history of BRAF mutant stage 3 melanoma that was resected. And she had a history of this primary biliary cirrhosis, so this kind of autoimmune biliary process. So in this patient with a BRAF mutation, clearly I think the right choice would be a BRAF and MEK inhibitor combination in the adjuvant setting. And I think one of the real clear messages is BRAF and MEK inhibition in the adjuvant setting really, really effective. And there's actually some ways you can splice through the data to suggest that it may even be a little more effective, at least in the first year, than adjuvant PD-1.
So the reason you picked targeted therapy, I was assuming that you didn't want to give her the immune therapy because of the primary biliary cirrhosis. Even if she hadn't had that, do you usually use BRAF as adjuvant therapy? You prefer it?
In anyone with a history of autoimmune disease, in the adjuvant setting particularly, and a BRAF mutation, I think BRAF and MEK is the right choice in those patients for sure. Let's put the autoimmune history to the side. How do we think about BRAF-MEK versus PD-1 adjuvant, which is, I think, the majority of the decision-making for a BRAF mutant patient with stage 3 resected melanoma? I think one could think about this in terms of toxicity. So I think the efficacy looks very, very similar. If not, maybe the first year BRAF-MEK even has more favorable recurrence-free survival advantages and even a more favorable hazard ratio in some contexts. However, the toxicities are very, very different. So how do I think about that for an adjuvant patient? Because adjuvant patients might already have been cured from their surgery. I think the issue is that BRAF and MEK toxicities are transient. So when you're taking the pills, you may have toxicity. And when you stop the pills, yes, the toxicity may linger a little bit, but it gets better over time once you stop. And it's extraordinarily unlikely to have any permanent toxicity with BRAF and MEK inhibitors. And with immune therapy, PD-1-based immune therapy, which we have in the adjuvant setting, although the majority of people will feel totally fine and the majority of patients don't have any significant toxicity at all, there are those people that will have really significant and or permanent toxicities from adjuvant PD-1. And so it's a conversation with the patients. Do you want to take a risk of long-term permanent side effect that might be severe with PD-1-based immune therapy, although the majority of people are fine? Or do you want to take a pills like BRAF-MEK inhibitors that are probably more likely than PD-1 to cause side effects, but the good news is if you stop the pills, you'll get better and everything will be okay. And so it's a tough patient conversation and a tough decision to decide who wants the pills that'll probably make them feel less well, but if you stop them, they'll feel better. And who wants to get the IV treatments with the PD-1 drugs that most likely they'll be fine, but there are some permanent toxicities like the endocrinopathies, like vitiligo, which can be permanent whitening on the skin. And that can be a big cosmetic problem for some people with PD-1, especially in the adjuvant setting where we're still trying to figure out who really needs these treatments.
That's a really interesting perspective. I actually haven't heard before. It makes complete sense. I guess now they're really, I mean, obviously, if she were a patient like this were wild-type BRAF, PD-1 would be on the table almost as a no-brainer. But I am really curious what you would have done in her with the primary biliary cirrhosis. I'm curious, I guess one of the things that would have to be considered is what you think her baseline risk of recurrence is. She presented with a left axillary mass, one node. Where was the melanoma?
She had an ulcerated melanoma on the left arm that was resected.
Interesting. And so she had one node, but 18 nodes were negative. So globally, when you looked at her, and I don't even know, maybe it comes up, maybe you actually talked to her about it, what were you estimating her risk of baseline recurrence would have been?
We have a new melanoma staging system now, which is really great. And so unfortunately, that it only shows melanoma long-term survival, so it doesn't really get to the recurrence risk, but you can imply what a recurrence risk might be. So with an ulcerated primary melanoma of moderate depth and a very large involved lymph node in the axilla that was surgically resected, hard to really be definitive, but recurrence risks in these situations can really be almost up to 50-ish percent. And so that's a pretty high risk of recurrence. And that's a patient that I would consider whether or not I should still treat her with PD-1-based immune therapy, even if she had a BRAF mutation, even with an autoimmune history. Her primary biliary cirrhosis was generally well controlled. She's on ursodiol, but not a patient that had active hepatitis or on immunosuppressants already. So she had this history, but it wasn't such a severe autoimmune disease and had a pretty decent risk of recurrence of around 50-50. That'd be someone even without a BRAF mutation I would consider for adjuvant PD-1. But people that have microscopic lymph node involved, a relatively shallow primary, no ulceration in the primary, those kinds of earlier stage 3 patients, I'm really still trying to wrestle with who really needs adjuvant PD-1 at all in those cases. And if a patient had any history of autoimmune disease in those cases, clearly I wouldn't take the risk for those kinds of patients. So she was a higher risk stage 3 patient with the size of the lymph node involved and the ulceration in the primary. So that would be someone I would maybe take more of a chance. But the whole point here, I think, is a good one. You have to really risk profile these people in terms of what is their real stage 3 melanoma risk and what is their risk of the treatment in and of itself.
So wow, this has been so interesting. We could go on for hours, but there are a couple more things I just wanted to finish out with. I was thinking about the issue of mechanisms of autoimmune disease. Like, what's the difference between primary biliary cirrhosis and rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease in the immune system? I assume it's not all the same. And which pathophysiology you think would be more likely to be affected by immunotherapy? I mean, I don't know if those kinds of data are out there. Any thoughts about that?
I think it's a really important issue because we need to learn from our colleagues who have been managing autoimmune diseases for a very long period of time, whether it's a GI doctor who's been handling ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, or even autoimmune pancreatitis, and from our rheumatologists who are handling rheumatoid arthritis and myositis or polymyalgia rheumatica. They have been using all kinds of selective immunosuppressants for a very long time in those diseases, whether they've been IL-17 blockers or TNF-alpha blockers, as in the case of Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And so in the immune therapy world for treating patients with cancer, we need to really try to figure out, are the mechanisms of autoimmune toxicities that we cause from our drugs similar or different from underlying autoimmune diseases in general? And then we can learn from each other. We can learn from the rheumatology world, and they can really learn from us. And one of the very interesting mechanisms that's out there at the moment is that there is a drug in rheumatology that's used for rheumatoid arthritis that's a CTLA-4 agonist. So instead of blocking CTLA-4 like tremelimumab or ipilimumab would do, it enhances the function of CTLA-4. So that's used to treat people with rheumatoid arthritis. And that's a very interesting concept because it tells us that you can agonize some of these pathways to treat patients with autoimmune disease. And it makes us wonder, should you agonize pathways related to PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade to help people with autoimmune conditions? We know that when you block PD-1, you can cause an autoimmune diabetes. So could we be reevaluating diabetes in general for patients without cancer, just routine insulin-dependent diabetes that's caused from beta islet cell in the pancreas destruction from autoimmune phenomenon? What can we learn by the fact that PD-1 blockade causes diabetes in patients with cancer? What can we then use in patients with diabetes to perhaps agonize PD-1 or learn more about autoimmune pathways in people with diabetes to try to help the vast, far more patients with these autoimmune conditions than patients with cancer getting immune checkpoint blockade? And how can we work with each other? I think that's a really important area, and we need this cross-pollination of rheumatology and other people to enter into the cancer treatment field so we can talk to each other, try to learn from each other, and try to help the vast number of people with autoimmune conditions. I think it's a great topic, and I think one that we still don't know a lot about.
Well, I think the other thing is actually maybe, I know it's obvious everybody wants to talk about what you do in the BRAF positive patient, which one do you use, which strategy to use. But based on what you were talking about, I think also the issue of whether you do anything, you know, the lower risk patient, you know, I mean, PD-1's not a walk in the park necessarily, or BRAF.
Absolutely correct. We don't know really that all these patients should be getting adjuvant treatment at all. And the reason we don't know about that is because we don't have overall survival information. The adjuvant COMBI-AD study with dabrafenib and trametinib did report some overall survival information, but it was not at the final analysis. So we can't really say statistically that overall survival was improved with adjuvant dabrafenib and trametinib. But for the PD-1s, we have no overall survival information in the adjuvant setting. So I think it's very justifiable to not use adjuvant treatment in some patients, especially those that are really low risk stage 3, because we don't know if the survival is better by giving adjuvant treatment at the time of surgical resection or only treating the people that have recurrent melanoma in the metastatic setting. And some of the adjuvant PD-1 studies, namely the one testing pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting, are being designed to test that question specifically. Do you treat people now after surgical resection of stage 3 melanoma, or do you only treat the people that have a recurrence of melanoma in the metastatic setting? And is there that survival advantage overall for treating people in the adjuvant setting? That's still an open question. Until there's an overall survival benefit that's proven for any of these drugs, I don't think clinicians need to feel compelled to offer their patient. I think that they should offer their patient adjuvant and talk about the risks and benefits, but I don't think observation is absolutely wrong, especially for certain patients and particularly people with low risk profiles. I think many patients I tell, we should just follow you. I don't think you need these drugs in the adjuvant setting because your stage 3 risk profile is so favorable.
Well, again, this comes up all the time in other parts of oncology. I think people pretty much agree HER2-positive breast cancer, you add pertuzumab, you get about a 20% relative risk reduction in recurrence, no survival data yet, and you take the absolute risk that you're looking at, apply the 20%, you get a number, and yeah, maybe you don't know about survival, but turns out to be, you know, less than 5% absolute difference in recurrence, people, you know, at least you have that information. That's way different than 50-50 chance you'll avoid a recurrence.
Absolutely. And I think it's an interesting general fundamental philosophical question of how does a patient anticipate and feel about a difference in benefit versus how does a physician anticipate a difference in benefit? What numbers should we be quoting? We should be quoting relative risk reduction. Should we be quoting absolute risk reduction? Should we use something like number needed to treat? How many people do we need to subject to the toxicity of these drugs to have one less recurrence? These are important questions, and we haven't completely fleshed them out yet, especially in melanoma. These adjuvant data are really, really still early. We have follow-up, you know, less than 2 years in many of these cases. And so I think that's still such a short period of time to make some of these decisions. So we're really still grasping in the dark about who should we feel should get these different treatments. So I think it's really hard to be really dogmatic at this stage because the data ultimately could end up all over the place.